The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, Disc 6.
The medium's mutterings gain volume and clarity as she speaks to no one, her words gaining speed to where they pour from her mouth in a waterfall of syllables and half-formed sentences. She is calling upon the house, the grand house, and requesting she be allowed through its doors, through its walls. In the midst of this chanting, she opens her eyes at half-mast and reaches out for the glass orb before her on the table. She looks different, not at all herself, younger perhaps, yet frozen in time. Again, a great gust of cold fills the room and runs up my legs. That glass orb begins to glow, I swear it, and tendrils of light, like a goo, climb up out of it and stretch for the ceiling. At once the candles are extinguished by this wind, the only light from the swirling blue and green tendrils overhead, and that glowing specimen of glass held between her withered hands. I think of my daughter, April, and her poor withered right arm. I think back to my prayers, so many years ago, as I was forming the children's hospital, that I would never know what to do if one of my own children was born deformed. Did I bring this upon April? Or did my husband, by passing me the African curse? Can I save my children? Mustn't my husband pay for his sins? Question after question is running through my head as I sit perfectly still while confronted with the agitations of my guests. Only Madame Stravinsky, Sukhina, and I remain unmoving and unflinching. Even John is visibly upset as he breaks his handhold with me and jumps to his feet. As he does, there is great chaos in the room. The shelves rattle, and books start slipping to the floor. Only one or two at first, then a score or more. The next score of books take flight, sailing across the room, aiming themselves at John and careening into the opposite wall of letters. Sit down, please. It is from my throat that my husband receives his instructions, and yet it is not of me. This voice, dark and clouded, jumps from me to Madame Stravinsky, and then back to me again. Sin is where it starts, sin is where it stops. Build me to the heavens, or the next man drops. First from my mouth, then Madame Stravinsky's. A moment later, everyone at the table is chanting in unison, and my husband shakes in his chair, to which he has returned. Douglas Posey stands to leave the room, and a volley of flying books strike the door and push it shut before he can escape. I tell you, dear diary, all that I write is true, as far as it is from any experience on my part. The room's twin electric lamps begin to swing. Slowly at first, then huge sweeping arcs, back and forth, and there's that wind again. Build me to the heavens, or the next man drops. We are shouting now, loudly, all of us, even John, whose jaw appears to move independently of him, to move in spite of him. Without warning, Madame Stravinsky seems to shed a skin of dark shadow, like a snake in season. This darkness rises out of her and over her, part ghost, like that I saw in the barn, only black, not white, part alive. It looms over the table, and we all stop chanting at once, for it seems about to do something, to attempt something. And it's quite clear that whatever it intends involves those of us surrounding the table. Come to me, says that darkness in a dry, deep voice that raises my hackles. Tsukina steps forward and grabs Madame Stravinsky's glass globe, attempting to wrench it from the table. She is consumed in a sudden burst of light. She appears to be nothing but a vague shadow as she strains to remove it. In an instant, Tsukina is thrown back off her feet, sailing through the air like the books only moments earlier. Crashing into the closed door, she sinks to the floor, out of breath and dazed. I leap from my chair, ducking from the books I expect to attack me, and am surprised when none flies. If this wasn't enough, it is only as I break from the séance to rescue my dear friend that the wind, and the sound of it, stops. Stops as if a window were shut. And here's the impossible part to believe. The candles reignite themselves. Silence settles over us all. That dark shadow that loomed above our medium is gone. Madame Stravinsky is awake. Eyes wide open, she stares directly at John Rimbauer. "What?" my husband calls out, dangerously loud, for his ears have not yet lost the singing of that cold wind. The medium merely stares at him. "What?" She does not answer. John storms from the room. Douglas Posey immediately on his heels. "Rubbish," Posey says, though not terribly convincingly. He's as wide-eyed as the rest of us. "My God!" I exclaim, feeling the knot on Tsukina's skull. "What have you done to her?"
"Everyone out," Madame Stravinsky declared. "You two stay," she added, indicating Tsukina and me. "The door," she said, once the room was cleared. The guests were only too happy to oblige.
"You've hurt her," I complained.
"She interfered," Madame Stravinsky explained, without remorse. "But I heard the message just the same."
"What message?"
"The message for you, child. The message from Rose Red." I glanced around the room at the devastation. A full half of the books were now on the floor. The wind had driven droplets of wax from the candles, spilled them onto the bookshelves. I shuddered. That spilled wax made the wind very real to me.
"What message?" I asked, though more weakly this time.
"It has promised you life. Life forever. Life without fear of death. Life without fear of illness. Your fevers will never return. As long as you keep building, so you shall live. This, I believe, answers a prayer once made by you. Your prayers are answered now. Life without death. Life without fear."
The medium collapsed in her chair, sagged across an arm, half on the table, half on the chair. She appeared unconscious.
"No, listen, Miss Ellen," Tsukina muttered her first words. "No, listen to this evil." "Life without fear," I whispered. "Life without death."
I looked around the tossed room again, held my friend tightly in my arms, and squeezed. "Rose Red has answered my prayers."
October 10th, 1914, Rose Red. Today, as Lyman C. Smith, of Smith Corona typewriter fame, dedicated the tallest office building in all of Seattle, the Smith Tower, construction on the newest wing of the largest private home began.
I often think Lyman and others are jealous or envious of John and challenge him with these engineering accomplishments. Here at the house, horse-drawn teams dragged plows and broke the earth while hordes of Chinamen shoveled furiously, filling wagons by the score. It is as if my former fevers, I have not taken ill since the seance, have spread to the project itself. I've hardly slept in the last month, working tirelessly around the clock on the plans and the arrangements to continue the construction of Rose Red. I fear I am leaving the children a bit too much to the governesses. I am told that April will sit for hours sometimes in front of the great working model of Rose Red and talk to the house in words that no one but she understands. They have called this state a trance, though I am loath to accept that. All children spend time in their make-believe worlds. April, just a bit more than most. She's an unusual girl. Nothing wrong with that. More important now is that I live on for my children. That I live to help them through this life. And Rose Red has made her promise, and I am not inclined to dismiss it as lightly as my dear Sukina. She remains infuriated with my acceptance of the seance, and Madame Stravinsky's performance, as she refers to that captivating evening. We were the talk of the town for weeks. Hour after hour, the workers outside the window toil. The new wing is to extend beyond the pool house and bowling alley, so as to not be seen from the approach, to not damage the continuity of the look of the grand house. It will add some 6,000 square feet on two floors, 12,000 square feet in all. A pittance of what is to come. We are adding 3 visitor suites, a 4-room home for Sukina, complete with her own kitchen, a bird room, a map room, and more schooling facilities for the children, as well as a projection room, so that we might view motion pictures in the comfort of our home. There is to be another pool, a hot pool this time, with salts from Europe, for cleansing of the spirit and treatment of arthritis, from which I suffer since the birth of our second child. This pool will be made available to my women friends, women only, for those who wish to purge the ills of city living. John has no doubt arranged for another of his viewing closets to overlook this women's pool, and though loath to accept it, I see no way to stop its construction, given that the final say with the foreman is John's, and John's alone. This condition I could not negotiate with my husband. I know such a room will be built, and I shall never find its entrance. I can imagine my husband enclosed there, my dear friends without garments, for the salt will harm the fabric, seen as God will have them. My husband leering, and him not knowing that I know. If possible, I may try to arrange an act or two to stun his curiosity. I am not without a sense of prank when it comes to John. I will not blame him for these transgressions. I have brought it upon myself by denying him any access to my chambers. Those days are over. With motherhood prevented by April's unfortunate birth, I see no reason for union with this horrible man. He can find his pleasure elsewhere. And he does, I'm sure. I take my pleasure from motherhood. It suffices for me. It fills me as a man never could. As a man never will again. The new wing shall rise from this hole in the ground, now being dug. It shall rise and give me extended life, as promised by Rose Red herself. I swear, at times I hear her. Not just the creaking of an old house, but the voice that inhabits it. A woman's voice, low and foreboding. A voice I heard utter from my own mouth. A voice that perhaps my little April hears too as she sits playing with her model. As to that, take note, dear diary. With these complaints of my daughter's continuing meditation on the brilliant model of Rose Red, I elected to take tea on the upper loggia. I instructed for April to join me, and that her model be placed there as well, so that I might see her playing with it, might come to understand the nature of these complaints from the governess. Daughter and mother did spend a lovely afternoon basking in the fall sunlight, warm and pleasant on the skin. I had tea and scones, and April ate a scone or two herself, a rare treat for me, since it is difficult to get April to eat anything at all. She played with the large working model of the home while her mother angled her wicker chair to face west, where the new wing's excavation was partly to be seen. I must have spent the hour there, April just behind me and to my right, explaining to my child the construction yet to come, how the new wing would rise from where once only lawn existed, would rise to fulfill our dreams and to hold our love one to the other. Finally, the sun cooling and my fever beginning to rise again, as it does so many late afternoons, I turned to instruct my little wonder with her withered arm that it was time to move inside for the day. I turned to offer my hand to her to help her stand. I turned, my voice catching in my throat. There, on the red Italian tile of the loggia's floor, I looked down upon the architect's model that April had so long ago claimed as her dollhouse. I reached out for my daughter's one good hand, and I gasped at what I saw beneath my child's pointed finger, a devilish grin owning her face. The working model of Rose Red had a new addition, complete and perfect, every window, every chimney in its place. The new wing, exactly as I imagined it in my mind. That wing had not been there on that model when our tea began. Under my daughter's care, that model had grown the wing all of its own. The model of Rose Red is alive, and the grand house along with it. October 12th, 1914, Rose Red. It is with heavy heart that I report the latest tragedy. As wife and mother of his children, I appreciate John Rimbauer's business acumen, the wealth he has accumulated, and I avoid, as much as possible, contradicting him in this regard or offering unsolicited advice. This, despite the fact that I do not hold the man himself in much regard. Today, however, I am desperate with dread over his treatment of his former partner, Douglas Posey, a man whom others continue to view as his partner, despite secret negotiations that have reduced Douglas to an employee, though a rich one at that. For I fear my husband's actions were motivated by disapproval of Douglas's private choices, rather than the man's business wherewithal. Oh, if that's not the pot calling the kettle black! While John lifts the skirts of his dockside whores, he condemns Douglas for taking up with his pale young men. This morning, Douglas appeared at the front door of Rose Red and was announced by his footman there. A butler hurried through the house, searching out John, and found him in the vast library and study off his chambers, where my husband puts in much time. John took his time responding, finally descending the grand stair in a slow procession that I am certain was intended both to make Douglas wait, as well as to indicate John's regal attitude as concerns his former partner. I had made a rare visit to the kitchen just beyond the grand stair to sample a soup to be served at a ladies' luncheon. I am hosting the board of the Children's Hospital lunch, and so was in a position to overhear the Lord and Master of Rose Red as he greeted our guest.
"What is it, Posy?"
John Rimbauer called out, still 60 feet down the entry hall. Lined with his African game trophies, the entry hall is a very masculine, very ominous place. All those glass eyes bearing down on one. The dead heads of former predators. Dead souls. I hate the place at night, being watched like that. Teeth glaring. The architect's working model of Rose Red has a home on a corner table by the front door and is only moved at April's request, shuttled around the house by butlers each day for her entertainment. We keep a bouquet, 9 dozen fresh flowers, on a sideboard in an Egyptian urn halfway down the entry hall, a new bouquet every 3 days, and the flowers throw color into the hall where much is needed. I bought that urn the same day the bandits tried to rob us in the market, the same day Sukina reduced them to cries of abdominal pain as we walked past to our safety. That urn serves as a reminder to me that to pass by it is to acknowledge such powers as Sukina possesses. Nothing is as it seems. The African maid is a witch doctor. The house is alive. The lady of the house is half crazy, or more than half, depending on the day. My husband stops halfway down that long hall, his eyes as dead as those of the beasts overhead.
Servants' entrance is in the back.
I've made some mistakes, John, a quivering voice acknowledged. I would like to talk to you about coming back on.
Not possible. I have a company to run. I'm busy.
You cheated me.
Nonsense.
You convinced me to sell my stock. And now, in just 6 months...
You threatened to sell your stock, Douglas. Is your memory so poor? I offered to buy it from you. Above market value, you may recall, in order to keep that transaction, those shares... from flooding the market and setting off a selling spree. You were only too happy to sell. That our shares have doubled in 6 months is tribute to a good product and firm management, management of which, as of today, you are no longer a part. This, because of your own despicable actions and promises made that were broken. End of discussion. Walter?
John summoned our doorman, who appeared miraculously through the doors of the grand ballroom.
Show our guest out.
Walter obediently opened the door. It is cold this October, colder than I remember. Douglas did not move.
I've gambled some in the market, John. I could use some help. Our guest will be leaving.
Please.
Now,
John said sharply.
Go to hell, Douglas Posey mumbled, not really meaning it, I fear.
Thanksgiving Day, 1914, Rose Red. Young Adam is 5 years old, April 3, and for the first year, both children understood the significance of Thanksgiving. John was delightful with the children, telling the story of the pilgrims and the first Thanksgiving. The sun blessed us with a fall day to remember. It had been cold of late, but not today. The servants had their own gathering in the carriage house, nearly 50 for Thanksgiving dinner. John provided them 7 fresh turkeys and bushels of yams, carrots, and peas, cases of wine. The day was one of much celebration, and served to remind me how peaceful a place this can be when in high spirits. I think that John's break with Douglas Posey has proved to be a wise move. He has been much calmer these past several weeks, less given to unexpected outbursts of temper. He even played with Adam, something unheard of these past several months. He has arranged for the construction of a giant toy train to occupy an entire room in the children's wing, complete with mountains, forests, bridges, and stations. It is to be an exact replica of the Seattle area and to utilize some 900 feet of toy railroad track, a quarter ton of modeling clay, a dozen gallons of paint, and 6,000 toothpicks in one bridge alone. Adam is to have the Christmas of his life. Oh, dear diary, thank you for the good times that outweigh the troubled. Thank you for Sukina, for the children, for our good fortune. Bless those who have gone missing when inside these walls, and give them rest. We have had no grave tragedy within this house for some time now. I hope and pray it shall stay this way. Perhaps Madame Stravinsky saved us. Construction continues unabated. This house is growing daily. February 20th, 1915, Rose Red. This family continues to pay for the sins of its father. I fear my children may never recover from this latest incident, and I am loath to prevent it, to stop it now, for it has already happened. The events of this story were not personally witnessed. Instead, they are put here in ink through my own interpretation of Sukina's having spoken in confidence with young Adam. He would only speak to Sukina, and no one else. This afternoon, Douglas Posey came to visit. He did not announce himself at the front door, was not greeted by one of the doormen. In fact, if the events of this day are to be explained, sawdust was found on his shoes, it would appear that Douglas entered the house via the new construction to the west. His motor car was found parked alongside the main road, pulled off into the trees. From there, he hiked the hill and crested to the west of the new construction, approaching Rose Red from a side where he might go unnoticed, as, alas, he must have so done. His next accomplishment baffles me, as mother to our children, for we employ no fewer than two governesses, Miss Crenshaw and Miss Dunn, and three other dedicated nannies, including April's wet nurse, Miss Helms, whom we held over to care for the children when her primary purpose had been served. The sole responsibility of all these women is to watch over the children. Nonetheless, for reasons that are not immediately explained, the children went unattended on this day, at the particular hour that I now relate here to your pages. Somehow, Douglas managed to make his way from the new construction through the pool house and the bowling alley to the south stairs. If one goes down these stone stairs, one is led to the game room, where John butchers and hangs his deer and elk after a hunt. Up these same stairs leads one to the west wing and our chambers. John, with five rooms, including his private study, and me with seven, including my dressing and fitting rooms. It was a cunning move on the part of Douglas Posey, for excepting the chambermaids who clean and service the linens, and the butlers who attend our fireplaces and chimneys, these rooms and hallways go unoccupied, except when I am infirmed, of course, more often than not these days, but as it happens, not on this day when I felt quite well. Particularly vexing is that, had any of those under our employ encountered Mr. Posey, he or she is not in the position to report it. John has long had installed in this house a strict rule of confidentiality, as he carries on secret business meetings, or at least that's the reason he gives, and can't have word getting out. He is, in fact, said to be investing in an aero company with his good friend Bill Boeing. I think it's a waste of money, personally, but John says aeroplanes will be important to the military. So had any of the servants seen or encountered Douglas Posey, they would not have mentioned it anyway. They would be loath to do so. Whether anyone did see Douglas as he entered remains unclear. We all saw him leave. It is no easy feat to reach the parlor undetected, especially from where Douglas Posey began his surreptitious entrance into our grand home. He understood the house well enough, and its internal politics, to increase his chances. The parlor's window looks out on the U-shaped pebble driveway, the fountain garden, which offers a welcoming splash of color year-round, thanks to our busy staff. He has been to the second floor plenty of times himself, to partake in one or another of John's many secret business meetings, and even knows several of the staff by name. One can only imagine why a person would go to such lengths as did Douglas Posey. But if there is one thing I have learned from my time in the company of John Rimbauer, it is that there is no predicting the human condition. The man Freud can make all the claims he wants. He is said to attribute nearly every phobia and fear to the physical intimacies between man and woman, sex, disregarding in the process the drive for sustenance, survival, and power. I trust some day his findings will be disproved, despite their apparent accuracy where my husband is concerned. What I will never understand, since I once imagined Douglas took a keen liking to the children, is why and how he chose the parlor, knowing how fond Adam is of playing there. Perhaps his decision stemmed from the presence there of an oil portrait of John that hangs over the fireplace. My portrait hangs in the entry hall, along with John's game trophies. The similarity of our situations has not escaped me. These portraits were commissioned while we were in London at the end of our honeymoon, and I must say they seem lifelike, the work skillful, though unimaginative. Indeed, John's portrait, looking so dignified, hangs with a view across the parlor and out an opposing window toward the drive, as if surveying his domain and contemplating his dominion over same. I can scarcely write the words, and without the high spirits that fill my glass, would feel helpless to do so. But the story must be told, and so what I have been told of it follows. Adam was the first to enter the parlor, on one of his safaris, where he encourages his sister, April, to forage ahead of him in the great hallways and make like game, as Adam attempts to track her. Little does poor Adam see or understand the significance of this practice to Sukina and me. Like his father, the game he stalks is a young girl. He must wonder why we discourage it so. He had missed a cue and lost April as she dodged into the smoking room, a room she is forbidden to enter, but girls will be girls. Adam swung open the door, his pop gun held at shoulder height and ready to fire, and apparently looked down that rifle barrel at Douglas Posey, who was himself halfway up a small wooden stepladder that is kept in a closet off the gallery to assist in the positioning and hanging of the artwork. Around the man's neck was a length of hemp rope fashioned as a noose. He stared at young Adam, the boy's physical similarity to his father impossible to miss. A moment later, dear April, with her withered arm clutched tightly to her spare frame, ran in behind her brother, in anticipation of surprising him and winning their little game. She, too, was confronted with the sight of John's former partner up that ladder. Douglas Posey tossed his hat to the boy, for he had come to our house dressed head to toe as a cowboy. Then he saw the girl and made a gesture toward her as well. Through the air floated a long-stemmed red rose. Douglas is very much aware of the nickname of our grand house. April's one good hand swiped the air and stole the rose from its descent, the thorns tearing her flesh and eliciting from her a sharp cry of pain. Douglas Posey stepped off the ladder and bounced in the air, his eyes never leaving my little girl until they bulged from his florid head, a blue pallor overcoming him. Adam claims he heard a loud snap, like a limb succumbing to the wind of a northwesterly blow. He pulled the trigger of his popgun, and its cork flew through the air and struck Douglas square in the chest, for Adam is a crack shot, like his father before him. Adam said Douglas danced, his legs jumping like when the Negroes do the tap at their parties. His tongue sprang from his mouth, a swollen, stiff mass, which was when both children screamed at the top of their lungs. April was found with her hand bleeding slightly, the rose still clutched firmly in her grip. Her eyes had never left the body. Adam was called back from his hands and knees, where he tried unsuccessfully to retrieve his cork from just beneath the body, fearing he had somehow killed Douglas himself and not wanting anyone to find the evidence. Across the parlor, from where Douglas swung from the hemp, his distorted eyeballs nearly bursting from their sockets, he stared, if the word is appropriate here, at the life-sized portrait of his former partner, my husband, who, it just so happens, and some say that Douglas surely knew this, was at that very moment pulling into the driveway and up to the house, returning home. From his vantage point in his motor car, John saw Douglas Posey, his stated enemy, swinging from his neck in the large expanse of window that fills the center of the parlor. Douglas offered him only his backside, stained as it was with life's final excretion. I think every servant on the property heard April scream. She hasn't spoken a word since. February 26th, 1915, Rose Red. For the last week, I have devoted every waking hour to my children, dividing my energies between Adam and April, though spending far more of my time with my daughter. I do not know how the male mind works, but suffice it to say, Adam's recovery seemed almost immediate. Whether there will be longer lasting effects of his witnessing the suicide, I do not know. And I do confess to these pages that I am fearful Douglas Posey's death will linger within him and surface for some time to come. Little April is another matter altogether. Neither John nor I, nor the governesses, nor Sukina, can get her to utter a single word. She sits, for endless hours at a time, staring at the architect's model of rose red. She dragged it in front of the fireplace in the parlor, and there she sits. She screams wildly if anyone attempts to move it, or her, for that matter. The staff has been directed to work around her, to leave her alone, and not to address her unless instructed, for her outbursts are paralyzing. I am apparently the only one she will tolerate, even near her. So, mother and child occupy the parlor. The hissing of the logs, the sharp popping of the pine sap, combusting, the only sounds. I have taken to knitting, for I find reading impossible in this state. In truth, I stare at my daughter's back, awaiting some sign of a return to normal. Twice I have lost my temper, though not for several days now, finding her silence insolent and enormously frustrating. I also, for a time, felt her prisoner, as if she had concocted this state of hers, taking advantage of the poor man's suicide as a means of capturing me into her web. I've spent more time with her in this week than in the previous 6 months combined. I fear this reflects on me poorly when viewed in the written word, but one must be reminded of my own infirmity. I have secretly ordered Abigail, one of the children's understudy nannies, to photograph the rose-red model each night before retiring to bed. This, on account of my troubling impression that it is subtly changing in appearance. I could swear that wings appear and disappear from one day to the next, and that the degree of these changes directly reflects the amount of time April sits staring. I fear, dear diary, that she is, in fact, not staring, so much as sharing herself with the model, with Rose Red. As absurd as this sounds, I tell you it is true. She enters a kind of trance in the company of that model, and does not come out until the fire dies and the room goes cold. This leads me to another entry here in your pages that I have resisted putting to ink for several nights now. It is time, for I fear the results if I keep such things locked inside me. My dear Sukina came to me the other night with a look of pure fright on her deep blue face. I inquired immediately what was ever the matter, and she would not speak to me until we found ourselves sequestered in my chambers with the door fully bolted. Our conversation went something like this. Sukina, what is it?
It's her, Miss Ellen.
April? The house. Her. Rose Red. I awaited her, expecting to hear more. When she was not forthcoming, I prodded her, compelling her to speak. She appeared spooked. There is no other word for it. Please. I finally obliged her. Maybe not the Indians, she said. What is not the Indians? I asked.
Me thinking, miss. Me listening. Listening to April, miss.
But April has not spoken for nearly a week.
Not to us, miss.
Sukina?
It like a wind, miss. A wind all round that child. A wind like a voice. Like many voices. Whenever she round that toy, that rose-red dollhouse, it why she no want me near. She knows I hear.
What are you saying? I felt exasperated. My daughter is what? Speaking to this house?
The house speaks to her, miss. Me think maybe not the Indians.
You're speaking of the disappearances. She nodded, still afraid. It is not often I have seen her afraid. Not Sukina.
What if, miss, if you think of it as fire?
Fire, miss.
Fire on our insides, Miss Ellen. Like that?
Life? I gasped.
The power of life, miss. Yes, the fire. And what if the house needs this fire for itself? The way you and me need our food?
Like that?
Fire, like that.
Not Indians.
No, miss.
Not the burial ground.
Not saying the Indians aren't here as well, miss. This place feels crowded at times.
She was right about that. We'd all felt it, even the servants. We weren't alone in this house. The occasional, unexplained Indian artifact surfacing in our collection seemed to support this spectral presence.
Are you saying...
I found myself grinning nervously. I felt terribly uncomfortable. I did not want to express what I was thinking, but we had come too far for such reservations. No walls exist between Sukina and me. Are you saying the disappearances? She nodded, knowing exactly where I was taking us. That Rose Red is feeding on these disappearances. Sucking the fire out of the mist, she nodded solemnly. I sputtered a little laugh, not at all comfortable now. She said ominously, I think it has to do with you, miss. No question about that. This house loves you, but I think it takes them others for the fire that's inside them. It living off that fire, Miss Ellen, she added, and the bigger she gets, the more she need to eat. I shuddered. But we're building her bigger, I reminded her, willful of Madame Stravinsky's decree. Maybe that woman, Sukina said, meaning Madame Stravinsky. She working for the house. Maybe that was the house talking, not her. I don't believe that, I whispered. Construction on the house is scheduled years ahead. As long as I keep building. I did not say it, but I was thinking, then I'm immortal. What I did say was, I trust Madame Stravinsky and what she told us about Rose Red. I added, my fevers are gone. Sukina knows me well enough to leave it at that. I suppose I should not have been so heavy-handed as I was, for I fear I put to an end any further discussion on the subject. Sukina rarely glares at me, but on this occasion she did just that. A wide-eyed leer of contained anger. I attempted to begin again. I asked, it's living off the life of the girls that have disappeared? She would not answer me. And what of the men who have died? I inquired. That between you and the house, miss. Me and the house, I echoed, feeling a chill. A window open? I wondered. The house protecting you. Mr. Corbin was not protecting me, I objected. We had never met. That man done shot the one man running the construction, Miss Ellen. That man Corbin, he been sent by the gods to stop this house being built. Stop her, before she ever started, she added. He done his best. It was true. Corbin had shot Williamson on the day the first stones had been laid. Coincidence? It added fuel to Sakina's theories. Maybe that was the Indians, I suggested, knowing full well Sukina remained suspicious of the Indians' involvement in the goings-on. She did not look pleased. It's sucking the fire out of them young girls, ma'am. The bigger she grow, the more girls be disappearing. Sukina know this. In here. She placed a wide hand across her bosom. I experienced another spike of cold, like a draft. Sukina rarely committed to her convictions with such words. She had done so when she had been convinced I was pregnant, and again when convinced young Laura would never be found. And now this. I fear I have grown susceptible to such suggestions, and I wonder at the woman I have become. Would the girl of 19 have believed a house could be alive? Could she have envisioned her closest friend being an African high priestess, capable of divining truths where no others could? A mother of two, one mute, with a withered arm, one admiring and emulating a man of questionable convictions? In just 7 short years, my life has so drastically changed to where even I do not recognize it. I cannot discuss such matters with my mother, for she is certain to misunderstand, to label me intemperate and harebrained. It leaves me in the care of my dearest Tsukina and her keen observations, her frequent connections with the other side. It leaves me wanting. I want my April back. I want her arm to be right. I want Douglas Posey to die someplace else, to leave this poor house and all of us in it alone. What if that model of rose red is growing? What if my daughter's voice has been lost to its greed? What if April is trapped, half in, half out of these walls that surround us? What is to be done about that? How do I return her to her mother, her family? I feel the need to shower even more love and attention upon the poor girl. I have ordered that she is to sleep in my bed alongside of me. I want her to find her mother's warmth when she seeks it, to hear her mother's voice when she awakes. If I am made to fight for her, I will. If you are reading these words, Rose Red, mark my word on that. I want to leave, but I know that is not possible. You will never let me go. Any of us, for that matter. We are your captives here. Immortal captives, but captives nonetheless. Whatsoever does it all mean? How long can I tolerate being under this roof with John Rimbauer? As powerful as he is, as rich as he is, I feel none of his love anymore. Adam has replaced me in his eyes. He brings presents for Adam, builds rooms for Adam's train, takes Adam on his business trips, along with the prettiest nanny. This does not escape a wife's eye. I am condemned. Rose Red owns me, not the other way around. I am a prisoner here. I must get April out at all costs. Her grandparents, perhaps. Ah, why had I not thought of this? What have I waited for? March 13th, 1915, Rose Red. The cruelty of marriage. It has been several weeks now since I mentioned to my husband my desire to get April out of this house. This morning I intercepted a letter delivered by a most unusual postman. Well over 6 feet tall, a bum right leg that caused him to limp, and the thickest of glasses. He came to the front door, mumbling something about a town in Italy. Florence, was it? No, Pisa, that was it. He said something like,
"Pisa for Rimbauer."
I have no idea where the post office obtains its delivery men. I hope our regular man Floyd returns to our service. The letter was posted 3 days hence from the Cheshire Academy, Portland, Oregon. I opened it immediately, with steam so that I might reseal it, and saw it to be a letter of acceptance for Adam. It appears John is far more interested in protecting his precious lineage, his heir, than his daughter with the withered arm and silent tongue. He believes April's difficulty with the language to be a reflection upon her intelligence, and probably her gender, if truth be known. John suffers behind a single-minded simpleton view of a woman's purpose on this earth, to provide men certain unspeakable pleasures and to bear children. Nothing more. I am a tangle of anger and grief, for I know my arguments will be lost on his ears. April will remain. Adam will leave us to attend the first grade. April is condemned with the rest of us. Adam is to be saved. I prepare myself to defend my precious daughter, but I know in advance it is not an argument I shall win. Nonetheless, it is a fight I shall give him. And if he ever returns to my bed with other matters in mind, which he's bound to do at some point, he shall find young April under the covers with me. So it shall remain, until he entertains a change of heart. Two can play this game. Three, if one counts Rose Red. And woe be to him who discounts her. Woe indeed. September 9th, 1915, Rose Red. It is with heavy heart that today I said goodbye to little Adam as he and his father left to deliver him to the Cheshire Academy. A mother's heart cannot bear such loss, especially in the face of my increased and failed efforts to evoke some manner of speech from my daughter, who remains in her nearly comatose state. To my horror, any attempt we have made to photograph the model of Rose Red has failed, as the images that are developed show a glowing white light where the model should be. It is as if the model itself were emanating some energy, some light, that spoils the photographs. In one, dear April was captured as well. The same white clouds extended from her hands and fully surrounded her head. If a trick of the people developing these photographs, it is no laughing matter, and I pray for them to stop. John blames it on dodging the images while they are being developed, and claims they are nothing but a practical joke. April's condition is known all over town. The European war is all anyone can talk about. John travels incessantly. Denver, Portland, San Francisco, even Cleveland and New York, his exports growing rapidly. The more he is away, the easier life is at Rose Red. So much of the tension here arises out of John's presence and the staff's fear of the man. The newspaper's front page is covered in worldly events. Germany offers not to sink ocean liners, a little too late for the Lusitania. Another city in Poland falls to the Austro-German army. Haiti is in rebellion. Switzerland hosts a meeting of the European Socialists. Our lives here at home seem to have such little purpose any longer. There is war everywhere. The German submarines sink dozens of ships every week. President Wilson is under pressure to join the fight. I know not where any of this might lead, but none of it looks promising. In terms of our lives, there are fewer social events, as so many of our husbands seem overworked by the run-up to war. Although the heads of staff and I have had our first meeting concerning the annual January ball, there is less excitement this year. The guest list is much larger, as John has added dozens of business contacts to the list. I have used my friendship with the Mastersons in order to arrange the invitation of a famous opera singer, Elizabeth Page, who will be in the city at that time. Miss Page, along with the film star Charlie Chaplin, should make it an interesting evening. John says William Randolph Hearst may attend, but he is most excited about some general he plans on inviting. This general has business with Mr. Boeing, and John, being a major investor with Boeing, is attempting to connect the two men socially prior to any discussion of business. My larger concern is Rose Red herself. She has been quiet for many months now, content, I suppose, to use her energies to grow with the construction. Just listen to me. How foolish this sounds. This construction, however, is scheduled to slow substantially, though not stop completely, this winter, as John believes the winter will be particularly severe. He reads the almanac and believes every word, and sees no reason to fight old man winter. What, if any, effect this may have on Rose Red, I cannot be sure. But my instincts tell me that a woman in want of attention will attention receive? And after all this frantic building, these many months, how will she react to her workers leaving her? her men deserting her. How will her mood affect our annual inaugural? Will she leave well enough alone, or will she seek some company? With John gone so much, a part of me says that Rose Red has nothing to fight for, that her dormancy results from the lack of a need to protect me. But if Sukina is right, and who am I to challenge her understanding of such matters, then it seems possible our house may find herself in need of substance, the subsiding construction no longer stealing her attentions. If so, to whom will she turn, and when? I am reluctant to invite a soul into this house. I am of the mind to call off the party altogether, for fear of guests disappearing. But never mind, dear diary. My attentions, my energies remain focused on my sweet child, April, and my attempts to win her back from wherever she has gone since Douglas Posey's cruel departure from this earth. Why has it taken me until this very moment to realize what must be done? How could I be so blind? Why must I write my heart to these pages in order to see clearly the way of it all? Sukina would never suggest it, for she doubts the powers so. But where have I been that I did not see this sooner? I must call Tina at once, for I now understand the course of action required to free my dear daughter from the slavery of her silence. Madam Lou! Madam Lou! If anyone can unlock this mystery, it is the great lady herself. We must go at once. September 12th, 1915. Rose Red. With John still in Portland, getting Adams settled at Cheshire, I took advantage of my independence and telling the staff we were headed to Sunday church, we were off. Sukina snuck through the back forest and out to the road, where, with me driving a two-horse, the three of us squeezed onto the carriage and headed off for Chinatown. Sukina, God bless her, had made the arrangements in advance, delivering a letter for me that was posted to Madame Lou. This morning, by return post, I welcomed confirmation that we would be received by the great lady at our earliest convenience. The wording of Madame Lou's note, and the steady hand that did write it, implied a translation, for the English was most correct and sound. I am under the assumption that one of her young, lithe attendants is also quite versed in the English language, and came to her assistance in this matter. This, in turn, warned me that the conversations taken between Tina and me in this woman's presence were probably better understood than we believed possible or likely. I made note to myself not to say anything to Sukina that I didn't want overheard. I must say that fear is entirely connected to familiarity. That is, when I first arrived at the door of Madame Lou's establishment, I can remember nearly shaking from vexation, given the condition of the place, and feeling intimidated and more than a little afraid. On this, my third visit, I felt no such apprehension whatsoever. To the contrary, I found myself excited, enthralled even, at the prospect of seeing the great lady again. Now it is that I can understand Tina's calm that day, the almost perverse peace she demonstrated upon our arrival. For her part, April demonstrated no enthusiasm for the change of environment, something I'd secretly hoped for. I suspect the condition of Chinatown must have registered in her to some degree, but this failed to manifest itself in any facial expression or noticeable change. Sukina, April, and I, hand in hand, climbed the dimly lighted stairs to the pungent odors of incense, ginger, and tea. The great lady occupied her throne like a monarch, and bid us to take rest upon her woven straw mat. As before, Sukina remained standing, slightly behind the two of us. A level of formality had developed between her and Madame Lou, if not outward respect.
"So this is Child,"
Madame Lou said. "April," I said.
"Pretty name. Pretty child."
She cut me off.
"Come here, child. Sit with Lou."
She extended her pudgy, swollen hands behind stiff arms that looked like tubular balloons knotted at the elbow. To my complete surprise, my daughter stood, walked the distance, and scooted up into the large woman's lap. For a moment, she seemed to get lost in the great lady's garment, like stepping behind a curtain and then peering out again. I smiled at her. Then my heart stopped. My daughter smiled back at me. It was the first such expression since Douglas Posey's suicide, and it brought tears to this mother's eyes. I am softened by the simplest gifts. The bearing of the great lady was formidable. She seemed to fill the entire room all of a sudden. The flames of the candles in the room, and I swear this is true, all bent toward that throne as if victims of a dozen simultaneous winds, as if water were running past them and down a drain directly beneath the great lady's lacquered chair. The room filled with added light, and for a moment my heart danced in my chest, and I thought I might be faint. She said,
"Mother, tell me, child, that you've seen a man take his life."
No beating around the bush for Madame Lou. This was the first that anyone, to my knowledge, had spoken so openly about Douglas's tragedy, and I feared repercussions. Again, to my surprise, April nodded.
"Madame Lou, understand, you no talk since this day. You hold your tongue. Madame Lou think, smart child, good girl, little April."
April looked up at the woman's swollen cheeks and beady, slit eyes.
"You no talk because the question not answered. Isn't that right?"
I bubbled out my surprise and began to sob as my precious little girl nodded right along with the great lady. This was, by all accounts, a conversation, and as such, nothing short of a miracle. Lou said,
"No one here answered the question for you, did they, child?"
April looked over at Sukina and me and shook her head.
"Until question answered,"
the Chinese woman continued.
"No sense in risking anything and ending up like that man. Dead as dead can be. Am I right?"
April nodded vigorously. "Oh, yes. Oh, yes." The candle flames stood straight up again. The wind suddenly lessened, or perhaps it was gone completely. I worried immediately that Madame Lou had missed her opportunity, and my heart sank like a stone. She read me from her chair and flashed me a look that urged I reconsider. And I realized this woman was inside me. She heard my every thought. I forced an awkward smile. Lou asked,
"Do you know the question, Mother?"
I shook my head no.
"You, darky?"
Sukina remained impassive. I wasn't sure where Sukina was at that moment. I had a feeling that she, too, was inside me, also reading my thoughts. Perhaps protecting me, standing sentry at my door. I struggled to stay conscious.
"The question," Madame Lou said privately to April, "is where did the man go? Isn't it, child?"
April looked shocked. I let out a yelp, and again was reprimanded by the big woman's glance.
"If he were no longer, where he gone? If still here, why he not talk?"
she said quietly and calmly.
So you no talk.
Where did he go? April said, speaking for the first time since the tragedy and causing me to sob with joy.
To the other side, my child,
Madame Lou said, still calmly.
You seen him there, yes? You talk, you and this man. Talk with no need to use mouth. He the one tell you no talk to others. Yes, child?
He said they'd never understand. Oh, I sobbed into my handkerchief, so overcome with grief and joy that I failed to hear the rest of what was said. It was over quickly. Madame Lou grinning, showing gaps where her teeth were missing. April hopped off her lap, cheerful as a bug, and scurried over to me. We hugged, and she must have thought me queer for my display. I waved over Sukina and requested she complete the business with Madame Lou. I would pay anything, offer anything she requested. Sukina promised to relay the message. April and I descended the dark stairs, my sweet, loving child already telling me all about the awful man who jumped from the ladder. If ever I doubted the power of the other side, today this mother's heart was convinced. Today I became a convert.
This ends Disc 6.